If I don't remember my father's name, who will? My father's name was Philip Alexander Kaplan. He was born in Brooklyn in 1909. I don't recall him ever at peace with his life. I do remember him looking serene once at Valley Forge, among the oaks and maples and magnolias, clustered around the numerous birches and pine trees, and a second time among the other hardwoods at Fredericksburg. These are trees I could not name when I was young, but learned to identify on later visits to those hallowed sites and to other sites on the eastern seaboard that the memory of my father inspired me to see. For it was only at such places, away from our immediate surroundings, that my father became real to me and real to himself. In particular, I remember him at Wheatland, James Buchanan's handsome federal-style home with the air of a southern plantation in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There I peeked my chin over the protective barriers into sumptuous mid-19th century rooms with their dark walnut desks and other antique furniture. Yes, I remember a grand piano there and many shadowy bookcases and lithographs. For long spans of my childhood, my memory is vague, but it lights up with minute detail about what matters to me most. Wheatland, where President Buchanan lived, worked, headquartered his campaign for high office and died, really mattered to me as a child. I was only 9, but my father in those rare moments spoke to me almost as though I were an adult, even as he was so full of tenderness. My father laid out the fundamentals of Buchanan's failure as president, perhaps the worst in our history, a story necessarily simplified for a 9-year-old. Of course, later in life, I would fill in more of the details. My first map of the United States was comprised of my father's images. It was a landscape full of lessons and marvels that I desperately wanted to experience firsthand. The flat prairie was something I never imagined as dull, but rather as an immense and magnificent prelude to something grander. I thank my father for that. In this, I would make several journeys from coast to coast, once in my late teens, hitchhiking, fueled with curiosity, obsessed with just seeing the West, then as a middle-aged journalist. And now, finally in my middle 60s, somewhat chastened by international events, hoping to learn something about America's place in the world by simply looking at the country around me. That's from the opening of Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World by Robert D. Kaplan, who, as the cover reminds us, is a New York Times best-selling author and a good writer to boot. I knew I was going to like this book and this author when I read those first few pages. How many of us are intrigued by perhaps the worst U.S. president ever? And who uses a trip to that president's home turf to open their book? That's daring, unexpected, and so, yeah, I'm hooked. The title, Earning the Rockies, comes from Robert Kaplan's determination to follow the advice of his father and earn the Rockies, go over those plains, by traveling on a cross-country trip where we start in New England, wending its way through the great American Middle West, into and across the great American desert, and up and over the continent's highest peaks. It's a journey recounted with breathless enthusiasm and thoughtfully observed commentary. We all begin our journey, readers and Kaplan alike, our trip across America, from the hills of Pennsylvania and the rolling countryside that nurtured the aforementioned President Buchanan back in the 19th century. We travel through the urban metropolis that is Greater New York City, taking in the New Jersey Turnpike on our way, and then spurt out into the river valleys with which so many of us are familiar. Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Des Moines. It is, as you can hear, a mixture of the bittersweet memories of our author's remembered past of America, his take on the changes roiling the countryside through which he drives, the present, and his hopes for America's future seen through that same lens of the great American road trip. Now note this, Kaplan takes us on our journey with the eyes and the sensibilities of an Easterner. He's East Coast, through and through, and he's self-aware of his lifelong lens, and it is this self-enlightenment that allows him to speak to us in the Midwest, and to Westerners a bit later, as easily as for those raised and nurtured in the East. Because Kaplan's honest with us throughout his writing, his long-nurtured and clearly stated myopia that all good resides east of the Appalachians, His audience will naturally expect the great road trip to be interpreted through that East Coast lens. Doesn't mess with my enjoyment of the book, and hopefully won't mess with yours either. But back to our story. Kaplan drives, as I have done, and perhaps you have, through the river valleys that bisect West Virginia and Ohio, older and now poorer parts of our nation. And in sharp contrast to the newly revived Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky region, not that far distant, it is the Big Ten universities of the Middle States that draw Kaplan's attention next. And it is Bloomington, Indiana, with a nod to Columbus and West Lafayette, Indiana, where he offers his easy but thoughtful musings, praising the Big Ten universities as a national, indeed international, locus of deep bench science, technology, and yes, liberal arts that make our country the intellectual and industrial powerhouse that we have been and will continue to be, as he optimistically writes. Another belt of oak, maple, and hickory forest, he writes, like in the East. For Indiana is a geographical transition zone leading to the heart of the Midwest. A true global civilization appears in Bloomington. Miles upon miles of expensive restaurants and well-appointed people, young and old. Outfitter and boutique furniture stores, you name it. Indiana University has more than 46,000 students at this campus alone, which includes schools of computing, public health, business, optometry, and environmental studies, with the engineering and agricultural departments located at the campus in Indianapolis and at Purdue, another public university in West Lafayette. The cream-colored limestone buildings with Victorian, Romanesque, and Gothic accents exude a stylistic intimacy. The Big Ten almost looks Ivy League. It reflects the educational reality of today's world in which the sciences are overtaking the liberal arts and are consequently where the money increasingly is. When people consider the big Midwestern universities, they think, because of the thought control projected by television sports, of football teams with beefy linemen bearing Polish, Czech, and other East European names and corn-colored hair playing in stadiums that each seat more than 100,000. They might imagine the sprawling campuses of stolid buildings, each separated from the other by hundreds of yards, in a vast and lonely part of America, where space is not at a premium. Thus, in the way that we all make the most tenuous associations, they imagine large student bodies in the great middle ranks of the social pecking order. They don't always think of Big Ten as elite, in other words. It is these schools, of which each state in the Middle West has an equivalent, much more than the Ivy League, that make the United States the power it is. Many other countries have elite schools and institutions to staff the upper reaches of their bureaucracies. France and Britain come easily to mind. What they do not have is scale, a deep bench, a massive complex of universities with millions of students only one or two ranks below the elite ones. What's more, it is at the bigger, only slightly lower ranked schools where much of the scientific, technological, and engineering research and training of America takes place, on which post-industrial society depends. And do not underestimate the liberal arts at these schools. In the course of my own career, I have marveled at the world-class scholars at Indiana University alone. In fields as disparate as European medieval history, Byzantine and Slavic studies, and the politics of the Indian subcontinent. Such scholars are as respected, if not more so, than those in the same fields at Yale or Harvard. The black soil of a heartland produces agricultural wealth, which is then easily transported by an arterial network of rivers and later trains, laying the economic basis for industrial power, the emanations of which have included and require the great public universities. The Big Ten, he concludes, is the capstone of a vast social, economic, and political process that, again, stares right at us, even as we don't notice it. And so it is that Earning the Rockies begins to take on the political flavors of the nation as well. In the Midwest states, Kaplan writes of his location-based insight into the ongoing strong urge towards isolationism that permeates this great American midsection. The strong feelings that isolating ourselves from the rest of the world outside of America is not only possible, but a natural state of affairs. Kaplan takes us into the roiling changes and forward movement taking place in so much of the Midwest, and notes, too, that this is the land of arch-isolationist Robert Taft, What a different take on America this is. And so we move on with him through Illinois. He makes note of the infamous time change and are treated to an extended stop at Springfield, Illinois, where we meet up with those essential elements of the modern Midwest, the ubiquity of trains, the importance of Abraham Lincoln. The countryside changes from the green hills and river valleys of the lower Great Lakes Midwest into the rolling and drier hills, the plains of Nebraska, a land where Kaplan sees the traces of the Mormons as they deepen their trek away from persecution and discovers the inklings of the modern-day sense of the West, with all of its iconic American mythologies and attributes as different in so many ways from the East in which he was raised and in which his book began. He takes us on an extended visit in this state, the state that Johnny Carson, a native and ultimate middle American of his TV generation, often referred to as the gateway to Kansas. There is so much more of this country to see, to experience, to revel in with this author, whose love for America and Americans is so evident with every turn of the page. Though bereft of photography, the book is no less powerful and moving for its dependence on text. Kaplan's words and phrasing bring us into the heart of the Pennsylvania Hill Country where we begin, take us into the heart of Bloomington, Indiana's famed campus, and deliver us in the end to Southern California and the epic naval base stationed in San Diego. The book indeed concludes with a sweeping look at America's place in the world based on that visit to the naval base in San Diego. As its subtitle promises, how geography shapes America's place in the world. Where Kaplan concludes, not totally convincingly to me, but nonetheless, that America, because of our geography and because of our people's response to this continental world in which we live, America is destined to take a leadership role in the world at large, like it or not. Well, be that as it may or may not be, his richly observed, beautifully experienced cross-country travelogue is worth your time. Whether or not you enjoy those final chapters, I think you're going to really like reading, experience this country anew. Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World, Robert D. Kaplan. Shout out to all the great things he has to say about Indiana. It's available at all of our fine public libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library in West Lafayette, Indiana.